Hello, everyone. Hello, good evening. Thank you all for coming. It's always such a pleasure to host events here with the Lowy Institute here in Melbourne. We always get like a really good, engaged, dare I say, very good-looking crowd in Melbourne. So for those of you who don't know me, my name is Lydia Khalil. I'm a research fellow with the Lowy Institute. I take a look on issues of national security, international terrorism, Middle East politics, but I'm here today with some three very wonderful, insightful panelists for our annual International Women's Day event that Lowy hosts every year. And before I introduce our panelists today and introduce you to the topic at hand that we're going to be discussing, I just want to first start by acknowledging the traditional owners of the land on which we meet, acknowledge their elders, past, present, and emerging. And so today we have our panelists with us to talk about women, protest, and activism. So 2019 was dubbed Year of the Protest. You had protests erupting all over the globe, from Algeria to Chile to France to Australia to anywhere, Middle East. And they've been popping up. And because we've been seeing around the world that trust in governments has seriously eroded, and it's been at an all-time low. And coupled with that, we've seen this creeping authoritarianism around the globe, even in democratic societies, that's been constricting the space where traditional political participation would have happened. But there's still some very urgent issues that need to be addressed, whether it's around climate change or working conditions, human security, human rights, women's rights, and all of these governance issues that urgently need to be addressed, but we are seeing that coupled with a lack of trust in governments. And so where is that energy going? It's spilling out into the streets. And so we've seen this really unprecedented political mobilization. Harvard political scientist Erica Chenoweth said about it that these mass protests represent a pronounced shift in the global landscape of dissent, in that there's more and more and more diversity of people that are mobilizing, and that these protests are largely nonviolent, leaderless, tech-enabled, and that the triggers of these protests can be small, something like the price of onions has triggered a protest in India, or very profound, like deaths and arrests at the hands of authoritarian governments. But what happens is, regardless of their triggers, is that these protests become these sweeping referendums and ultimatums put to government to enact these broad structural change. But these mass street protests, though, are only part of the story. We have other forms of activism and conscious raising that's happening across the board, either through artistic expression, like the exhibit that maybe some of you have seen before coming here today to listen to our panelists, through writing, polemic, and yes, even political participation and lobbying. And we're seeing that women are playing actually a very prominent role in this advocacy and activism and protest around the world. And there seems to be something distinct about the advocacy and protest movements that either are led by women or women make up a very significant portion of those movements. So, like I said, to mark International Women's Day this year, we at Lowy wanted to explore the role and experiences of women within this context of the global protest and activism movement. And so here today to talk about that are three really terrific panelists to offer three distinct perspectives and experiences, and to share three distinct experiences about women, activism, and protest. So we have Louisa Lim, who is an award-winning journalist and who's reported from China on China for a decade now from outlets like National Public Radio and the BBC. She's been following and writing a lot about the Hong Kong protests. She's a senior lecturer at Melbourne University and has also written an excellent book called The People's Republic of Amnesia, Tiananmen Revisited. We also have Amanda McKenzie, who's the CEO of the Climate Council in Australia and one of the best-known public commentators and advocates on the climate crisis here in Australia. And even though she's the youngest CEO of the Climate Council, Amanda has a very long history in climate activism, having previously founded the Australian Youth Climate Coalition and has served on renewable energy export panels for the Queensland and Northern Territory governments. And Amanda was also the founding chair of the Centre for Australian Progress and is a former board director at Plan International Australia and the Whitlam Institute. And last but not least, we have Nayadol Nguyen, who is no doubt a very familiar face to us here in Melbourne. In addition to her day job as a commercial litigator at Arnold Bloch and Liebler, she is a very active community advocate and a very frequent public speaker in the media and in other forums. Her advocacy is centered around the African-Australian community, human rights, multiculturalism, the settlement of refugees, and those seeking asylum. And she's volunteered extensively in relation to these areas and worked with government and non-governmental organizations to do so. So please join me in welcoming the panelists tonight. So I want to offer up a few of my own questions and then later on this evening open it up to the audience. And Louisa, I wanted to start with you. So the coronavirus is all over the news. We were chatting about it, here on the stage before the audience came. People are panic buying toilet paper. I don't know why. more seriously, though, the Chinese government's response, or lack thereof, has actually deepened anti-CCP sentiment in Hong Kong. But I've read two contradictory headlines about this. The first one is that the coronavirus has actually fueled more protest. That was one headline in the Washington Post. And the other one in ABC News Australia saying that coronavirus has quieted the protest down. So I want to ask you two questions related to this. First, which one in your assessment, having followed this, is true? But more importantly, second, whether or not the protests are either slowing down or reignited in the immediate moment, clearly the pro-democracy movement in Hong Kong is not going away anytime soon. And you've emphasized that the Hong Kong protests are a whole-of-society movement and that it's been a leaderless resistance type of movement. And so I wanted to ask you, why is it important to label the Hong Kong protests as a whole-of-society movement? What does it tell us about the nature of the movement? And what role do women play in this broader whole-of-society movement? It's a lot to unpack there, but I know you can do it.
Yeah, that's a lot of questions.
Yeah.
Thank you. I think, strangely, both of those things are true when it comes to the coronavirus, because a lot of people in Hong Kong have been self-isolating in their own apartments. I think the movement has kind of gone through this lull where there have been less large street protests. But I think that's also the moment at which it would happen is now, because there have been so many arrests. I think to date, 7,300 people have been arrested, and quite a lot of people have been charged with crimes such as rioting, which carries a 10-year prison sentence. So I think the costs of protesting are getting much higher. But we are also seeing these protests that kind of merge the coronavirus and people's sort of underlying distrust of the government. So when the government tried to use a new housing center to put suspected coronavirus cases, people started protesting and they even set it on fire. And then, of course, we've seen all of this panic buying, which very much is fueled by distrust in the government, which, as we were saying, is an interesting parallel to what's happened here in Australia. Mm. But when it comes to the gender sort of side of the protests in Hong Kong, I think they're very much a whole of society political movement. And we can see that through the district elections, which were held in November, before all 18 of the district councils had been controlled by pro-Beijing groups. After the elections, pro-democracy candidates won 17 out of the 18 councils. So this is massive turnaround. And I think it's interesting because we've seen this mobilization among groups that have not in the past necessarily been out and been very active. And some of those groups have been specifically female groups, but many of them have not. So we've seen housewives coming out to protest. We've seen mothers protesting. We've seen this group who called themselves the Grey Hairs, sort of senior citizens, but they were largely women. And they're mobilizing as well. So I think that when you look at the demographic breakdown of the protests in general, it's something like 46% of the protesters are female. So it is a whole of society movement. But I think one of the interesting things is the way that the movement has cast itself, the figure that it has chosen to represent, the figure of protest is Lady Liberty. And there was this statue that was produced by protesters, and they crowdsourced the design. They decided who should be the iconic figure that represents the Hong Kong protester, and the figure they picked was a young female protester wearing a gas mask, holding an umbrella, because that was what people use to protect themselves from pepper spray and tear gas, wearing a hard hat. And then this figure was built, crowdsourced. Money was crowdsourced for a 3-meter-high statue of Lady Liberty, which was built. And then as a sort of symbol, this statue was carried to the top of Lion Rock, which is this quite high mountain. And it was interesting that after a day, it was pulled down and vandalized. So I think, you know, the potency of the symbol is quite obvious, even to the, those who do not support the movement. Mm.
It's interesting how women feature in the iconography of a lot of the protest movement. Like, we've seen that with the Sudanese protesters, for example, you know, had this beautiful image of a woman in white robe and these gold hoop earrings be the symbol of the Sudanese protest movement, which toppled Omar Bashir. And it's interesting to hear you say that it's similarly, this is the case in Hong Kong, even though it is this broader whole of society movement. Mm. But Amanda, I want to turn to you next to discuss another issue that's not going away, which is climate change. So, you know, here in Australia, the bushfires have been at the forefront of the media attention and all of our attention. We've all experienced the effects of that major climate change impact here in Australia. And we've had protests like the Extinction Rebellion and the climate protests going on in Australia. So, I wanted to ask you about the interplay of protests like that in the climate space and other forms of advocacy, like the work of the Climate Council, for example. So could you tell us a bit about the interaction between, say, on-the-street protests, communications, lobbying, and other forms of advocacy when it comes to the climate issue?
I think with any social justice issue, you need a spectrum of organizations and individuals and groups that are doing a whole series of different tactics. And in the climate space, it has tended to be relatively narrow, particularly if you looked at it from a media perspective. Who are the voices that are speaking about climate change? In the past, it's tended to be academics, politicians, and some other experts. So it leaves climate change in quite a elite media space. In the last years, we've tried to do this, but it's also happened organically. There's a whole range of new voices that have been speaking in the climate space, and often led by women. So there's a whole lot of new organisations, Farmers for Climate Action, Emergency Leaders for Climate Action. There's musicians speaking out about it. There's Parents for Climate Action, Surfers for Climate Action. There's sort of plethora of new groups starting up, and a whole range of new voices being able to articulate the problem. And that's been reflected in the protests as well. The student strikes, which were inspired by Greta Thunberg in Sweden and her Fridays for Future, and swept around the world, but nowhere more so than Australia. The protests that the school strikers have organised were bigger here than in any other place. And they were very impressive, particularly because they were able to be so peaceful, so clear in their demands, which is very hard around the climate issue because it is so broad. And then they were also able to engage so many different parts of society in those protests and attending them. They were also supported by a range of organisations, helping them with bits and pieces like the media strategy or things like that. But the students did an amazing job in leading it. The Extinction Rebellion is a different beast altogether. I think that, again, on a spectrum, I think it's really important that there's organisations that open space in the public debate for organisations like us, the Climate Council, that can be seen as a sensible middle rather than being on the edge. And when the Climate Council was established 6 years ago, this was just before the Blue Mountains fires at the time in 2013, and we came out very clearly with a bunch of scientists saying this is climate change in front of our eyes. The Prime Minister at the time, Tony Abbott, said they're totally wrong, they don't know what they're talking about, and there was a big debate amongst journalists and politicians about whether you could even link a climate event at the time to an extreme weather event to climate change. Today it's very different. We've come a long way, and I think it's important to have groups like Extinction Rebellion, in a way, open space for others that to emerge as the sort of sensible organisations when they should have been viewed as that anyway. But if you have a lack of individuals and organisations really, pushing the envelope, sometimes that can be missing. The Extinction Rebellion, they've emerged quite organically and some of the tactics haven't worked very well, some of them being counterproductive. But I think broadly the movement needs those that are pushing the envelope. Mm.
So you touched upon a little bit the shift in climate activism and how there's been a lot of female-centric and female-led type of activism. Tell us what that looks like. What's either driving women's involvement in climate change, climate action advocacy and protest? Does the advocacy of women around this issue look different? What are the roles they're playing? Can you tell us a bit more about that?
Yeah, it's interesting. I started working on climate change 15 years ago, and when I would go into a room of other not-for-profits working on climate change, I was often the only woman, and I was definitely the youngest person there. But now when I go into rooms with lots of other not-for-profits and charities working on it, it tends to be mainly women, and there's lots of younger women involved. I think there's a number of reasons for that. I think that the movement has changed quite significantly in that time from more of that lobbying direct political focus to much more of a grassroots activation and mobilisation perspective. And so there's more groups like the Australian Youth Climate Coalition or the Australian Conservation Foundation has changed their orientation to be about community organising and mobilisation. But there's also lots of new organisations that have been primarily led by women. My guess is that that tends to be that women are the majority of the volunteers in Australia and more willing to do stuff for nothing. So when it comes to starting new things, women tend to be the ones that will get up and say, well, I'll have a go and I'll do it. And I think there's also a lot more organisations that are supporting people with a leadership from behind, if you like. So there's Farmers for Climate Action, for instance, is a group that has tended to be a group of women that have been in the agricultural and farming space, but the people you'll see speaking for Farmers for Climate Action tend to be the men with the Coopers on because they'll often resonate most with the target audience. Mm-hmm. So I think women the women that I observe in the climate space have not been very ego-driven. They're not there to put their own profile out there. They're there to make an impact on the issue.
Mm. So it's a kind of a question of tactics and what works and what doesn't, at least within our current context. So speaking of tactics, Nidal, I wanted to ask you about a particular tactic in form of protest that women are taking up. So, you know, women are often very socially conditioned to be polite, to consider the positions and feelings of others, first and foremost. But female activists have recently been using a strategy of radical rudeness and televising anger. And that's something that you've pointed out in some of your writings as well. So, and women in Africa have actually been at the forefront of this phenomenon or this strategy or tactic of radical rudeness. So can you tell us more about that and how it's playing out either around the world or with some African advocates that you know?
Sorry, I just had to take my earring out because it was just making some really weird noises. I like them, but I think it might be more useful being heard. The one of the women that has used this tactic quite effectively is Dr. Stella Nyanzi in Uganda. If you know much about Uganda, it's that it's been under a dictatorship for the last 30 years, and it doesn't seem to be going away soon. And all forms of resistance have sort of failed because he cracked down quite heavily on protest. And what Dr. Stella Nyanzi did was just to be rude. And he called, he said that Uganda might have been better had the president died at childbirth, and I think referred to him as a pair of buttocks. And that has ended up with her being arrested a number of times for essentially rudeness and insulting the president, and she just got released recently from prison again. And I think what she's done, it's protest in a way that makes it almost impossible for Museveni not to reply, but makes any conduct that if he does reply, makes things look as if he's overreacting. So he seemed to be caught in a very, caught in a very tough space. What Stella Nyanzi did during her sentencing was take off her top and flash her boobs. And it you know, for an African woman, that's pretty radical. That's turning things upside down, because the idea of a 50, 40-year-old woman doing that is quite confronting. And of course, she's been rebuked from the churches to the street. But I thought I'd read something that a young girl wrote, as what Stella Nyanzi symbolized for her. She said, "I refuse politeness. I dedicate my life to unlearning respectability, because at the end of it all, divine freedom is fearless. It is not neat and pretty and dainty. It is rude. It is vulgar. It is naked. It is wild. It is unashamed. It is raw. It is profane. It is indecent. It is loud. It is demanding and disrespectful. It is you, Dr. Stella Nyanza. You are divinely free, and they cannot take that away from you. The entire revolution has already happened inside of you, and we get to experience that from your life, your words, your work, hoping that we can meet you where you are in whatever capacity we can. You have taught me that when we are silent, we are more at risk of pain, of suffering, of living lives suspended in unsubstantial strings of fear, always waiting on where our next small redemption will come from. You have taught me that the process of truth is rewarding, not in the ways in which the world rewards, but the ways in which the spirit rewards. The process is indeed the shortcut. It is the homage to freedom, to the channel between us and liberation."
So it's pretty powerful. Yeah, that it is powerful what that tactic evokes, isn't it? And speaking of powerful movements, you know, another one that's been clearly very prominent and intersects with gender and women's rights is the Me Too movement. And so, Louisa, I wanted to ask you about the intersection between the Me Too movement and the protest movement in Hong Kong. You've had some interesting observations about that. How have they come together, and why have they come together in the example of the Hong Kong protests?
Yeah, it has been a really interesting time. And I think it kind of stems back to what happened 5 years ago in the Umbrella Movement, when there were also large numbers of protesters on the street and lots of women protesters. And you saw these examples where the police would sexually harass protesters, or they'd, you know, in front of the cameras, in front of many witnesses, and there was nothing that could be done. And then we even saw some quite remarkable cases. So there was a woman who was actually charged with sexually assaulting a policeman with her breasts. And she actually was convicted of it and sentenced to 3 years in jail. And the sentence, she did not have to serve it, but, you know, it went through the court process. So there has long been this... it's been a tool that's been used. Gender violence, I think, has been a tool used by the police against protesters. And it's quite effective because it serves as a tool of intimidation. You know, if you get picked up, who knows what will happen to you in police stations or in prison. And then what we saw this time has been several young women, in particular one woman, stood up, gave her name, and talked in great detail about her experience of being sexually assaulted inside a police station. And I think it made it harder for people to deny that this was happening, that, you know, there was a face to this, there's someone willing to stand up. And so we began to see these protests which sort of merged the two with a special hashtag. So Hong Kong protests and Me Too was protest too hashtag, where there are protests, you know, for the movement but against gender violence. And I think in that way they've been quite useful in raising awareness in a society where people don't really want to talk about these things, even though they know that it happens. And I think that's been quite important, especially because there are so many young women involved. I think, you know, to have the ability to speak out about these things openly and to be believed. I mean, you know, that's it shouldn't be this way, but I think the movement has sort of opened that space for that conversation to be held in public.
Well, that's certainly, you know, a positive aspect of some of the negative tactics that, you know, authorities have been using to push back some of these movements. So, you know, we talked about the intersection between protest movements and the Me Too movements. And Amanda, I wanted to talk to you about intersectionality as well, too, and ask you about that in the climate advocacy space. Can you talk about kind of this tension within the wider climate movement between the best way to promote progress on environmental policies? I know you'd mentioned before that there's some advocates who feel it's you won't get certain climate or environmental justice if certain voices aren't heard. So I'm interested in your thoughts about intersectionality when it comes to climate advocacy.
I think there's two sort of schools of thought. There's the climate justice school of thought, which is essentially that the climate issue intersects with a whole range of other issues. In Australia, that's particularly been Indigenous issues, but it intersects with a whole range of different issues, and that there needs to be solidarity with those movements. So one of the phrases is you can't have climate justice unless you get Indigenous justice, for instance. So, and that can be extended to a range of different issues. The view is that if you are not addressing these other issues, you won't address climate change. And the ultimate one ends up being capitalism itself. We can't tackle climate change unless we change the whole system. And then there's an alternate view, which is that it's more a practical view, if you like, that the window of time to tackle the climate crisis is so short that we don't have time to work on other issues, that it should only be this issue. And it tends to be more of a technical series of solutions and political solutions rather than solutions that would go deep into a whole range of other systems. And there is a tension there that's, and there's a whole lot of views in between, obviously. I think my view is that you've got to take a little bit from column A and column B. I think that the urgency of the climate crisis drives a lot of my decision-making. And that as an organisation, I think that we need to be conscious of where our issue is obviously bumping into other issues. But for the large part, we need to be very focused on what this issue is in and of itself because of the existential crisis that it will bring to every other issue if we don't get it under control. But that said, there's a range of ways in which the climate issue is very obviously connected to other issues. So, for instance, large fossil fuel projects tend to be on Indigenous land, and the Indigenous owners of that land are important allies in challenging the projects, or in contrast, can be for the project. And so there's a whole lot of issues there to work out. Environmentalists over the last few decades don't always have a good reputation for working well in those scenarios and meeting the Indigenous owners in where their interests are. So I think it's a really important one for the climate movement to consider, but I think the climate justice movement at its worst can become very insular because you can have so many intersecting issues because climate touches everything that you end up appealing to a very small group of people, and it's very hard to argue a whole lot of different cases at once, whereas for the most part in terms of changing the climate debate in Australia, the issue is that we haven't been good enough at reaching the middle Australian audience, and there's sort of more people that would have a cautious attitude to the issue. So for my two cents, that's sort of where we're focused.
So some people aren't ready for that systemic change just yet on that one. Nidal, I wanted to ask you, somewhat related, because if we're talking about systemic change around women's rights and gender, you know, when we talk gender, obviously we're not just talking about women, we're not just talking about, you know, what role women can play in this. We also have to speak about men and masculinities and what that means. And you've advocated for men to take a greater role in promoting and ensuring gender equality. But you pointed something interesting out, you know, contrasting to the stereotype of this, you know, patriarchal, big, bad African male, men in Africa have actually, and male leaders in Africa have actually been at the forefront, really, of promoting gender equality and promoting women's rights in Africa. So I'm wondering if you could tell us a bit more about that and what's happening there.
Yeah, I think particularly in the early 50s and 60s, when most African countries were becoming independent, but some of the thinkers around that time, well, I think Mwalimu Julius Nyerere in Tanzania, Thomas Sankara, I think they were quite forward-thinking when it came to women's rights, maybe to some extent Nelson Mandela as well, because you know when he got in prison, Winnie Mandela sort of took on the mantle of fighting apartheid. And in fact, women were quite involved in bringing down that racial regime in South Africa. But I think Thomas Sankara stands out for me in the way that he, and to be honest, I still struggle to find men, I think, that think in that way, in the way that he doesn't approach the women issue from women vulnerability, but from the position that they're integral to any changes that occur in how we set up society itself. Mm-hmm. I think it goes as far as saying that we can't achieve, you know, we can't achieve true equality unless we dismantle the systems that exist in the first place. And perhaps he was much more willing to go there because in the 50s and 60s, African countries were dismantling the systems of colonialism. Mm-hmm. So perhaps that kind of thinking that was available to him much more readily. I think, though, the generation of African leaders we have right now, I won't say that they are as forward-thinking. Mm-hmm. And I think part of the problem is that sometimes the hate is exported from outside of Africa, and then on arrival, it's named as, you know, prejudice and backwardness from Africa. And that has been effectively done by some evangelist groups, for example, who have campaigned strongly when they go back to places like Africa and sort of sell through these really weak governments in need of money, sell through the charity vein, this very conservative view of the role of women and gender equality. And I know that Margaret Court, I think, is doing the same now and are working quite closely with a well-known regime that prosecutes and kill people who identify as gay, as lesbian. And I know she's working closely with them to try and establish church there. But I wanted to again read the words of Thomas Sankara himself, because I think he, you know, he captured it much better than
I'm just
what
mindful
I was
of time, though, because I do want to.
Oh, sorry.
Leave some
maybe
time,
I'll leave it then. Yeah.
But if it's a short bit, please go ahead.
So, in other words, in order to win this battle that men and women have in common, we must be familiar with all aspects of the women question on the world scale in here in Burkina. We must understand how the struggle for the Burkinabe woman is part of a wide-world struggle of all women, and beyond that part, the struggle for the full rehabilitation of our continent. Thus, women emancipation is at the heart of the question of humanity itself, here and everywhere. The question is that universal in character.
I wanted to ask you to bring it back to here in Australia and your experiences, Nidal, in terms of your advocacy in Australia. I wanted to ask you about social media and advocacy. You know, you're a very prominent person on social media and in the traditional media as well. And while these platforms have opened opportunities for new voices to be heard in ways that we haven't seen before, there's some problematic aspects as well to it. You know, the social media platforms have become problematic spaces for women and particularly women of color. You've written about this, so I would be interested to hear your thoughts more on that topic.
I think as I explored it in that Guardian, the Guardian article, to be a woman of color, I think to be online, you have a choice between no debate and uncivilized debate. I don't think that the conversation about having civil debate really covers us, because if you see the way someone like Yasmin Abdul-Majid was treated and continuously bullied there was a lot of civility in that debate. I also think that there is very few spaces in which we can really be in sort of echo chambers, that people call it. By the very experience of being different, you constantly come in contact with different experiences. You don't live necessarily in a society where it's governed by people who look like you, you're just never going to exist in a bubble. So I think in that way, you experience the hard edges of social media most of the time, a lot of the sexist and racist abuse. And I get, you know, I get that all the time. Every single article I write, every single media appearances I do, I have to set aside a time to think of either blocking. I'll always end up blocking at least 10 to 20 people on Twitter, because just yesterday I think someone said that I was too dark, they could only see my teeth. I mean, and that's mild. That's one of the good ones. But you sadly get used to, you know, making that choice of, do I continue to remain in this space because it might be useful? And I've had interactions with, you know, women from all backgrounds, but predominantly, you know, black and young girls that have said that the presence in media was important for them because it was one of the few ways they were seeing themselves represented in a light that didn't cast them as potential criminals or a danger to society. Mm. So it's a hard balance, I think, but it's a useful tool. You know, it's an equalizer. It means that if a mainstream media says something that is not accurate and there's no option of replying to that, then there's a possibility that you can do so on social media and draw attention to it. And that sort of leverages a little bit. Otherwise, there have been no other options but to try and find ways in the mainstream media. The challenge will always remain, I think, in Australia until we see greater diversity in the media. Mm. It's really poorly represented. Mm.
But it just goes to show that, you know, women, in particular minority women, have to contend with a lot of other considerations that others don't when it comes to their advocacy efforts or even just getting their voices out there. So,
yeah, and sorry, I know that it's a short time, but I really want to make add something else. When you talk about, you know, balancing those things, I mean, I want to be a lawyer. You know, I don't want to be on social media doing social commentary. You know, but you had an election where it was run on this law and order issue that really painted people of African background in the most horrible light, and you felt compelled to reply, and that's hard because you think, I came to this country, I want to put my head down, I want to learn a skill. And people begin to think that your job is actually a media commentator as opposed to a lawyer. So mm-hmm. I am a lawyer. but you know, that balance, it goes farther than just your own sense of self. It impacts your work and, you know, your relation with other people. It makes you question whether or not, you know, you are developing your career in the right way. Like all these little questions that sometimes, the best way to summarize it, sometimes I wish I had other people. Problems, you know, like, yes. You know, like that I came through with, you know, I wish that my problem was what kind of kombucha I'm going to drink as opposed to, you know, as
I
opposed
had raspberry
to,
lemonade today. It was good.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, as opposed to what the Prime Minister or the Minister of Immigration have said about people who look like you.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to be mindful of keeping some time for audience questions, but I did want to ask one more question of you, Louisa. You know, we've been talking a lot about some topical issues and issues that are immediately in the press, but one of the really interesting advocacy protest movements that you've written about is the Tiananmen Mothers. And they've been perhaps in the background, but they've had such a longevity, even in the face of, you know, more crackdowns within China on rights and freedoms of assembly and the authoritarian tilt of the CCP. So can you talk about the Tiananmen Mothers before we open it up to audience questions and tell us about their longevity and how they've managed to keep this issue alive when, you know, as we've discussed before, this issue of Tiananmen has not been adequately portrayed in the media, has never been dramatized, is often ignored, but they've managed to keep this issue alive.
Yes, absolutely. So when I was writing my book, I was a correspondent in Beijing, and I went to interview one of the co-founders of the Tiananmen Mothers several times, and it was just, you know, this sort of extraordinary story, but it made me see the sort of the way in which even authoritarian regimes have this weak spot, which is actually the weak spot is the sort of power of the mother figure in a way, because these were women whose In the case of the main two co-founders, their sons were killed in 1989 when the tanks rolled into Beijing. And in both cases, their sons were very young. One was 19, one was 17. And they were shot by the troops as they entered. And ever since then, these two women set up this group. And although it's called Tiananmen Mothers, there were some fathers as well. And, you know, they meet, they raise money for other people. And then every year they write letters lobbying, three words, truth, compensation, and accountability. And they've been doing that ever since 1995. So it's really the first political lobbying group in China. And it's run by, you know, these women. And they saw that the power of their position was that the government could not clamp down on them in the same way that it could against lawyers or human rights activists, because it had already sinned against them by killing their children. And so they used that opportunity, and they continued to just use that as a wedge to kind of break open the space for political activism. And I mean, it's interesting that year after year, the government really pays attention, an awful lot of attention, to what these women do. So, you know, normally they began by putting out their statements on June the 4th, the anniversary of the killings. But after a while, the government began to put them under house arrest or take them on forced holiday so that they couldn't be interviewed. Mm. And that just started to get earlier and earlier. So they were, you know, giving out their statement, not in June, but, you know, in May, then in April. And when I went to see her, Zhang Xianling, the woman that I interviewed, she told me this story. And she said one year she had gone to the spot where she discovered the spot where her son was killed. And it was on the roadside. It was beside the gates of a school. And it was a particularly awful sort of sequence of events, that he was shot, that people tried to take him to hospital, that they were forbidden from taking him to hospital, that his body was buried in a flower bed, and then it rained, and then the body started to smell, and it eventually got excavated and taken to hospital. And because he was wearing an army belt, they didn't burn his body because they thought it was a soldier. So she eventually found out what had happened to her child. But she went to this spot to mourn her son, and she just did the funeral offerings on that spot. And then the next year she wanted to go back. It was a private remembrance by herself. She wanted to go back. She went back, and she found they'd put a closed-circuit TV camera just trained on that one spot. So it was literally just waiting for her to stop her from remembering her son, because, you know, the power of that grief, the power of that memory was so strong. And actually, I did also bring something to read, which was something that she said to me that I just, it stayed with me for so long. She said, she was just talking about the Communist Party, and she said, "Such a great, glorious, and correct party is afraid of a little old lady. It shows how powerful we are, this group of old people, because we represent righteousness. They represent evil. They're afraid of us. We're not afraid of them."
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think that's a good summary of a lot of the people who've been involved in protest movements this past year, and clearly, like the Tiananmen Mothers, who've been involved for a long time. I think we've had a really great start to the discussion. I want to leave some time for the audience to ask questions. I'm sure that there's a lot. So what I might do is, if you have a question, please raise your hand. We have microphones roaming around, and I might take three at a time just for consideration if there are any. Any questions at all? Otherwise, I have more. I'm happy to keep going. Yes, please.
Sorry, it's a little off par from women's activism, but I just had a question for Amanda. So obviously lots of people are doing some really important things right now, being sort of like more conscious in their consumption and things like that. I wanted to know what you see as sort of like an ideal future, maybe in the next 5 or 10 years, of how sort of at an industry level things can change across Australia. So like, it might, you know, be a bit sort of far-fetched or unrealistic, but like, what do you see as like important sort of crucial changes that maybe the energy markets will be making, so like into different renewable energy things and stuff like that.
Okay. Any additional questions? Just maybe up front here.
Thank you to all of you for fantastic interventions. Really learnt a lot. I would be interested to know what your opinion is on the relationship between feminism and women's activism in protest movements, or in the types of protests that you've been speaking about. To what degree is women's involvement in these protests also part of a wider landscape of, if you like, a new generation of feminism? And to what degree does their involvement in these movements also help to reshape feminism in the 21st century?
I thought I saw one other hand right here. And then we'll let the panelists answer the question.
Thanks. It's a bit of a follow-on from the last one. But when you look around the globe and you see all the different cultural contexts and sort of socioeconomic conditions that from which these protest movements are arising, what do you think? Do you think there are any consistent sort of enabling factors that are promoting these movements now?
So climate, the protests and broader feminism, and what's enabling these broader movements. Manda, do you want to start about climate?
Yeah, sure. So what does it look like in the future if we take action? Well, we did an analysis last year of the 47 sectors of the Australian economy. Where are emissions going down or up? In almost all of them, they're going up at this stage. And the core solution to climate change is emissions need to go down, so we'd be using less fossil fuels across the board, less coal, oil and gas. And the first point is to change our electricity system. So that means predominantly in Australia we could move to a very high penetration of renewable energy, predominantly solar and wind, with some battery storage, and that would satisfy the grid. But we don't just need to get to 100% renewables for our grid. We need to get to more like 500%, 700%, because the next step is to electrify all other industries. So we want to electrify all of our transport. We want to look at heavy industries in Australia and see if we can convert them to be using more renewable energy and storage. We would look to manufacturing, for instance. The strategic advantage for Australia in 5 to 10 years' time could be that we have very cheap clean energy, in contrast to having very cheap coal-based energy. We're the sunniest country in the world, we're one of the windiest, we've got a huge amount of land, so we've got a lot of capacity to do that. There's also a discussion about exporting renewable energy. So renewable-based hydrogen could be a liquid fuel that is then exported. There's also an investigation by Mark Cannon-Brookes and the Sun Cable Company to be exporting energy directly, electricity directly from the Northern Territory to Indonesia. So those are two things. We firstly go to electrify renewable-based electricity system, electrify other industries. Then we need to look at land management. That means basically making our landscapes more sustainable agriculture. And then the final thing is about mining and exports. So Australia is one of the largest fossil fuel exporters globally, the largest exporter of LNG, I think number two in terms of coal. So changing what we export, not just to hydrogen and another energy source, but thinking more broadly about what the Australian economy looks like as we start to move away very quickly from coal and other fossil fuels.
Any thoughts from the other panelists about the broader feminism and enabling some commonalities in the enabling of all these protests?
Yeah, I think in Hong Kong it's been really interesting. I don't think it's driven a kind of feminist awakening, but I think the movement has opened up a whole lot of other roles that women can play and other sort of role models. So in the past, there was this stereotype of Hong Kong girl, Kong Noi, and she was very like, I'm sorry, but she was very materialistic. It was all about shopping and handbags and labels and things like that. And since the protests began in June last year, the whole image of Kong girl is different. Now it's more like Lady Liberty. You know, it's someone in jeans and a shirt with a hard hat on with a gas mask. And maybe they're not on the front lines. Maybe they're working as a medic, providing help and putting saline solution in the eyes of people who've been tear gassed, or maybe they're doing graphic design and designing posters for the movement. Because the philosophy of this movement is be water, it's a very kind of fluid movement with no leaders, where people decide themselves what they will do. I think that has given women more agency to sort of do other things and be seen to do other things. And then we have seen other types of female role model emerge. And I think a very important one is the singer Denise Ho. And actually, it's interesting that we're here today, because we were meant to do an event with her and the artist Badutar in Melbourne, which was actually meant to be here last year. And it was moved because of security concerns, some said, but there were some questions about whether censorship was also an issue. So I'm really glad that we're able to talk about these issues at the NGV today. And I actually had quite a lot of messages from people on social media, mm-hmm. People in Hong Kong saying, please make sure that you mention this today mm-hmm. and that you bring up this issue of talking about what's happening. But I think that people like her, who've really, she's traveled around the world, she's been to the UN Human Rights Commission in Geneva, and has, you know, become another sort of face for the movement. She's, you know, she's female, she's gay, she's a pop singer, she's not the kind of normal Kong girl. So we are seeing other types of role model. As regards the question about what are the commonalities that drive the movements, I don't know about in other places, but one thing that you see in Hong Kong that really drives it is the lack of responsiveness of the government. I mean, you know, you've seen this demand for more democracy that has been voiced in so many different ways for so long. You saw the umbrella movement in 2014, where people spent 79 days on the street trying to get democracy, and the government did not make a single concession. And on July the 1st this year, last year, the protesters broke into the Legislative Council building. And because the structure of the Legislative Assembly is already so, it's kind of gerrymandered, so pro-Beijing forces will always be in a majority, no matter what happens. So, you know, breaking into the building was a protest against that kind of non-representative democracy. And I was there at the time, and I went into the building, and there was, right when you went in, there was this pillar and graffiti, and they trashed the building, but they mainly trashed the symbols of the government, you know, the emblem of China on the wall, the signs of, you know, portraits of pro-Beijing politicians, and there were certain things that they left completely untouched. In fact, they protected them, like books and artworks. But what really struck me was when you went in, graffitied on this pillar was this sign saying, "You taught us that non-violent protest does not work." So, you know, that kind of, I think really that sentence sums up what was behind the movement in Hong Kong.
I think in Dr. Stella Nyanze is outright say she's a feminist. And I do think that I can't speak for the whole of the African continent, as diverse it is. but I do think that the act of leaving the household is in itself a form of feminism to me, because it's beginning to challenge the assumptions that women are supposed to be, which is quite still the case in certain places, be in the kitchen cooking the meal for everybody. So I think that Stella Nyanze particularly is really inspiring a whole generation of feminists in Uganda and across East Africa. It's you can see the resistance in some areas of young women wanting to call themselves feminist. I think it's now had a really bad name as anti-men. But I think maybe by claiming it so boldly, that she's allowing young women to claim it bolder too.
Hello, my name's Laurie. I have a question for you about your personal experiences. If you could draw on an experience or experiences that you've had where you've been in circumstances and you've drawn on your strength and possibly even extended into rudeness to you know, make a point, had people in front of you looking at you and stood up, because you would inspire me. You are inspiring me, but hearing this would inspire me even more.
That's a good question. Are we answering?
Of course, we'll open it up to all of
them. I think when I was 20, I wrote an article on why I'm not a good Sudanese woman. So that was my first form of protest, is to just say, all these labels, you can have them back. And I remember one of my friends who is male and said that he was very pro-women rights coming to me and saying, that was a very stupid article. And I remember saying, I meant it exactly for you. But it made me realize how even in my own community, men had got used to our politeness to be deferential when they say mean and horrible things, that you can't stand up. Somehow it was not feminine to stand up and say, this is my body. You know, I remember there was an article written by another South Sudanese male writer on Facebook where he was complaining about women and how women choose to use their bodies. And I remember replying to it and someone saying, you can't use that language, you are a woman. And I remember telling him, and this is going to sound quite vulgar, why you don't possess a vagina? Why do you get to say that word, but I don't get to say it? And I have one. You know, but it's amazing, like, how it's appropriate for men. Like, I didn't get that, but even just that, to use that word, it makes me, as a community leader, not respectable, even in Australia now. So it's amazing how controlling it is, and why I think that concept of radical rudeness is interesting, because it's just saying, you have your labels, I'm not dealing with them anymore. And I think people find that really offensive, as if the woman body is sort of a company on which everybody is a board member and have a say about it. and I think radical rudeness is just firing them.
Yeah. Fire the board.
Yeah.
I love that concept of radical rudeness. And I've got two short stories. One is the Climate Council comes as a evidence-based scientific organisation primarily, and then we are a communications organisation too. And when we started, when Tony Abbott had just come into power, we were previously abolished as a government body that crowdfunded to create a new not-for-profit. We're very conscious of the political discourse and how easy it was for scientists to be dismissed at that time. But what can happen if you're under an intense degree of scrutiny, which we were at the time, everything we did, we'd have the Daily Telegraph trawl through every presentation I did trying to catch me out. We'd have every article that was published, that people would be looking into every report, all of that. So we had to be incredibly careful, and that can cause a degree of self-censorship. So about a year or so ago, we did a bit of an interrogation into our language and said we need to be bolder and braver in the things that we say. So Scott Morrison at the UN last year said that Australia was taking great action on climate change. We were doing all the stuff that we needed to do, blah, blah, blah. And I just rang our media advisor and I said, this is colossal bullshit. And she said, would you say it on TV? And I said, oh, I don't know about saying it on TV. What? I don't swear on TV. My mum would not like that at all. But I then said, no, good idea, let's say it, because it is. And it ended up being a huge headline that day. I didn't tell my mum, hoping maybe she wouldn't notice. She noticed. She didn't like it. But I felt really empowered after. I didn't get criticised by anyone except my mum. And I thought, you know, that radical rudeness is a real place for it, and particularly for advocates in the climate space, we have been very polite. The second very brief story, to sort of take it back to the feminist question as well, I think I started my journey in the climate space, as I said, with often lots of older men. And, of course, just like any other sector of a society, you know, it wasn't immune to sexual harassment and all of those other things, and being talked over in meetings and all of that. And I sort of noticed about 2 years ago when we were in a meeting with a whole lot of climate NGOs, one of the younger women stood up and said, I just want to let you know I'm leaving. I find this space really uncomfortable. As a young woman, I feel like I'm not respected and left. And I thought, wow, there was kind of a, the men in the room really didn't want to take that on, kind of talked around it. And I thought, I've now got a responsibility as a somewhat older woman in this space to take, to really own what that woman has said and expose some of my own vulnerability. And having worked in a relatively male-dominated space, I've never been vulnerable in front of others, and it was a really hard thing in that moment to do. I ended up crying when I talked about it, which I was like almost died, but I was like, oh, how could I have cried? But actually it was really good to cry. I think it shocked everyone and just described some of my own experiences of the difficulty of being a young woman in that space, and I think it actually really impacted the other men in the room.
So radical rudeness and radical emotion.
Yeah. Together. Being vulnerable.
Yes.
I probably use radical rudeness far too much in my daily life. But when I was first in China, when I first went out there, I was the BBC correspondent, and it was really hard for people to understand that because I was 32, I'm half Asian, I looked about 20, and everybody, literally everybody from, provincial leaders all the way down to cleaners condescended to me. And I found it really so annoying day after day after day of people doing this. And there was one particular story that I remember where I went to Xinjiang and I interviewed someone in the health ministry, and I was in the next room, and I heard him talking to his co-workers, and he was just like, God, I can't believe the BBC sent an intern. I was so angry, but I actually didn't. My instinct was to be radically rude, but I was just like, wait a minute, that would be the obvious thing to do. I'm not going to do that. So instead, I just went along with this whole intern thing. I looked really stupid. I pretended to be really stupid, and I lured him into saying really stupid things, and then wrote a story about it, and of course it made headlines. And that was quite effective. And the thing that...
That's tactical rudeness.
Yeah.
But the thing that happened, I think, was that over the years, we have seen this shift. When I started in 2003, all the foreign correspondents, they were all white, they were all male, and that's why people had this idea in their mind that the correspondent must be male, and they must be white. And that's why people found me so hard to accept. You know, they'd ask, are you the translator? Are you the fixer? Are you the secretary? You know, and now, if you look at what has happened in China, almost all of the correspondents are Asian and almost all are women because we have the skills, right? We have language skills. We also have the smarts, and we can also get into places where men can't get. We can get the stories like the Tiananmen mothers, all those generations of male correspondents. Did they actually go and talk to them? No. You know, once a year, they'd write a sort of boilerplate story saying, Tiananmen mothers, blah, 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 you know, annual statement, blah, blah, blah. But they would never tell their stories or even try it and understand their stories. And I think that is something that we were able to do as women journalists. And I'm just so happy now when I look at those bylines and I see all the Chinese names and, you know, increasingly few sort of white people being parachuted in who are not able to speak the language and not able to kind of really negotiate those things. Although I would say there are some good male reporters as well. I don't want to say only women make good reporters.
Yeah.
But I think this trend is fantastic, and I just wish that we would see more diversity in Australian newspapers. It's a real, and in media in general, it is a real failing, I think.
Yeah, it's quite noticeable when you look at other countries, the level of diversity in their media. It's quite shocking. But you know, in Australia, we're very careful of the R word. I don't want to end up on Andrew Bolshaw tomorrow.
Well, there's certainly a power to being underestimated. Illustrated that. Louisa, Amanda, Nidal, it's been such a pleasure to talk to you tonight. I've learned so much. No doubt the audience has learned so much too. I'm sure we could have gone on for another hour or two. So I just want to ask the audience to join me in thanking you for being here for this event.